and welcome to Perspectives, which is a series of inspiring conversations with remarkable working women. And I am really excited to share today's interview with you, talking with Joanna Grover, author and executive coach. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Katie. I'm delighted to be here with you.
So you have had such a great career journey. And I'm wondering if we could just sort of jump in. I don't want to waste any time. We have so much to talk about. And just give us like a brief overview of you and your career.
Sure. Well, I'm from a big family in Long Island. And I was the first girl after three boys. So I think I came out of the womb just trying to figure out my place in this world. And what better place to do that than psychology? And also, like, I was always called to be of service. So I was an activist and started an environmental group in my 20s after I graduated school. And then I really wanted to understand more of the human mind. And I went to NYU, to their great social work school, graduated, and really concentrated on anxiety, which was something I think that was in, you know, no one talked about it, but there was a lot of it in my family. So I wound up treating it, specializing on treating panic attacks for 2 decades. And then I was introduced to something. I'm always looking like for like, what's the next thing? What's something that can help people like faster? Like everything in our world has to somehow be more effective. We have to be more effective as clinicians. And when I read about this use of imagery to shape human behavior, I was like, that is fascinating. I want to know more about that. So I became the first person in the US to study this form of imagery training called functional imagery training. I came back and started a whole company around it with some of the developers of this, and bringing the research to the people. And that's how the book came about. And we really, you know, I felt like this had been like cloistered in the ivory tower. I was like, we have to let people know that they can change the channel in their head. You know, we just have to teach them how.
Well, as someone that has had 2 panic attacks in my life and thought each time I was actually dying, you know, this is extremely interesting to me. But talking about sort of changing your mind, before we jump into talking about your book, which I really want to do, I just would love to talk a little bit about the power of our minds. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, you know, we operate off of these stories and dialogues that we tell ourselves that are often not even the truth. How much power do these thoughts actually have? And how much power, more importantly, do we have in terms of changing them?
Two really good questions. They have incredible power. And this one story that I think demonstrates it so well, right? Because you can read about something in a textbook or study something, but when it unfolds in front of you with your own kid, like, it's something you never forget. So my son, my older son, is allergic to horses. I know this because I used to ride horses, and if there was a horsehair around, he'd have an allergic reaction. And we were going to see a production of War Horse at Lincoln Center. There isn't a horse in the production. It's puppets, right? So there's no horsehair. They're like bicycle parts and sticks and glue. And midway, I'd say, into the first act, when you start to believe that this puppet is a horse, my son started to have an allergic reaction. He's allergic to horse hair, but the idea that there was a real horse in front of him triggered a histamine reaction. He, like, I didn't know what was happening. I thought he was choking, but he held his neck and he couldn't breathe. And then he pointed to the horse. And I, in that moment, all I had to do was whisper to him, "Honey, that's a puppet, not a horse. You're allergic to horsehair." And his symptoms completely subsided. That is our brain's ability, you know, wired to keep us safe, right? Wired to keep him safe. But once it started to believe something was real, it triggered a real reaction in his body. And that was an aha moment for me. I mean, he was 12 at the time, but that stuck with me.
That's amazing. I mean, that is absolutely amazing. Well, can we talk a little bit about cognitive behavioral therapy that I am a big believer in? You mentioned your son. It helped my daughter immensely in high school. And I would especially like to know how it can help people with anxiety, because there are so many people that are dealing with anxiety right now, perhaps more than ever, or perhaps that's just me thinking it's more than ever.
Sure. No, I was drawn to study cognitive behavioral therapy. And actually, this imagery work is born out of that CBT, if you will. CBT is very practical, right? Someone comes in with a problem, a panic attack. That's where most of my referrals came from. People, it was the number one reason at the time people went to the emergency room were panic attacks. So they'd come to me and I would work with their thoughts, feelings, and behaviors and give them homework. So in cognitive behavioral therapy, you're really interrupting an automatic thinking problem. And this thinking triggers feelings, and then they can go down rabbit holes. But you're getting them to interrupt the automatic thought and to replace it with something based in reality.
So if someone, so I found for myself, I've had two panic attacks in my life, mm-hmm. as I mentioned, and thought I was dying both times, but I have found other times throughout my life when I start feeling that panicky feeling, if I put something like a candy or a piece of gum in my mouth, it kind of helps me. I don't know why that is, but I do that. And so I always have it with me just in case. I haven't had a panic attack in years, but knowing that it's there kind of helps me. Is that sort of the same? What do you suggest for someone that might be having a panic attack or feels like it might be coming on?
Yeah, well, first of all, like your experience, you really feel like your life is coming to an end. Like your life is being threatened. So you're really in your reptilian brain. You're in fight, flight, or freeze. And it really feels like you're going to die. But people don't die of panic attacks. That's the first thing to understand. It feels like that, but that feeling is not a reality. So what you're experiencing is very interesting. I don't know if a therapist helped you with this, or you figured it out on your own, but you're redirecting your attention to something, a taste, and you're redirecting your attention to maybe that sense of taste and the soothing quality of it. So this is the basis of our work. We train people that they can redirect their attention, or what we say, you can change the channel. So it's brilliant that you came up with that, because the fastest way to interrupt a negative pattern or a negative behavior is through our senses. It's not through more thinking, because if you're in the throes of a panic attack and you start thinking, that's really hazardous. It gets worse, not better. So focusing on your senses is a much faster way to disrupt that panic.
Well, interesting. So I really credit where credit is due. My dad told me that my grandmother, used to have panic attacks, and that's what she did. So she figured it out.
I love it. Good job, Bubby.
So let's talk about The Choice Point, an amazing book, and I highly, highly recommend it to everyone. It really has begun changing my life and how I look at things. Can you share a brief overview of your book and what motivated you and Jonathan Rhodes to write it?
Sure. So it is the science of functional imagery training, right? It is the science of how we use imagery. Our mind can either be for us or against us. And we teach you how to get your mind with you, on your team, if you will. It's very scientific. So everything we introduce in the book is driven by science. So it's essentially how you can get where you want to go and get out of your own way. It's the science of achieving your goals. It was born out of a desire. We use this measure of unconscious motivation. I'll have to give, we'll talk about that a little bit. I don't want to get too off topic, but Jonathan and I are both driven to be of service. And so writing this book was really like, we had to take time from he has a little son and a wife and a busy academic schedule. I took time from my job to really, it was like, we're doing incredible work, but what if so many more people around the world could experience this? The university gets floods of people wanting this work, but they don't have enough trained people. So this was one way, and we've been translated into 9 languages.
Wow.
Most recently, this week, we launched in Mexico. And the interesting thing is they changed the title of the book in Mexico. So as you know, in the U.S. and around the world, it's The Choice Point. In Mexico, they changed the title to No Success for the Indecisive.
Well, you can't argue with that either. It's a bit wordy. I wonder why. Do you know what was the motivation for that?
Well, I did a lot of interviews last week to help the launch of the book there. And there were so many great questions. The interviewers there are very different than our interviewers tend to be like skeptical and prove it to me. And they were sort of like, can we dive into when your head and your heart aren't agreeing on something? Can we dive into the difference between procrastination and indecision? Like, they were asking amazing questions. And I think, in this world, we're inundated with decision making. I don't know. I'm imagining that some of the people listening to your podcast run companies or they have C-suite jobs, right? They're inundated. They have decision fatigue. And it's getting worse, not better. But if you're indecisive, it's like the story we tell in the book of the mule who couldn't, he's placed equally between water and food, water and hay. He was equally hungry and thirsty, and he couldn't make a decision, so he died, right? So that's an old French story. But if we don't make decisions that allow us to adapt to the world as it's changing, we're not gonna thrive.
So from there, can you explain the FIT method? Or is it FIT or FIT?
Yeah, FIT. You're right, FIT. Yeah. So FIT is a combination of two things. One is listening. So if I'm a FIT practitioner, I'm really listening to what you're saying. I'm listening to what you're saying. I'm also listening to what you're not saying. It's a whole method of eliciting someone's true motivation. Okay, so it's listening to understand what someone's real motivation is. Usually it's not what they came in with. There's something underneath. And then once we know that, and that's tied to their goal, then we measure and train their ability to use 7 senses to put themselves in the future and to make choices that are going to serve them. The technical term is motivational interviewing. That's what it's called in the literature. Mm-hmm. It's motivational interviewing and imagery.
Why does it work?
Because even with, advances in the computer and in the world of tech, there's nothing greater than human imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And we are really tapping into human imagination. We're clearing the noise. And there's still nothing more powerful than that.
So the title of your book, Everywhere But Mexico, The Choice Point. What is a choice point?
Yeah, so we have so many choices in a day. I love how the researchers can measure this, between 35,000 and 60,000 choices in a day. And they're considering a choice like, what do I have for breakfast? And what pace do I walk? What word do I choose next? Like, these are the little choices that we're on autopilot for, right? So we're not talking about all those little choices you make in a day. The choice point is really about the big decisions. Do I take this job? Do I marry this person? Do I sign up for this very difficult task ahead? It's these decisions that define us. Do I quit? or do I keep going?
I always thought it's interesting because so much of it are so much in someone's life are the choices that they make and when they decide that. And yet there are other choices that are made for you or other things that happen to you, which immediately necessitate you making additional choices that you weren't having the luxury to say, like, do I marry this person? Do I not? But all in this second, you have to make choices that often define where your life goes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we're specifically talking about the choices that are within your control. It's true. There's a lot that life throws at us that are outside of our control, but we're talking about, like, most people are living on autopilot.
Yeah.
Right? We are wired to do the same thing yesterday, today. And we're also wired to be negative. Over 80% of our thoughts are negative. So we need a tool to get out of this routine. If we're really going to achieve greatness, and that's why Martina Navratilova was the perfect person to write the forward, she achieved greatness through great adversity. And it's really, you know, she understood fit before it was a science. She understood the images and the senses that she focused on were going to shape her success in life.
She's an amazing, amazing person. A big part of your book has to do with setting and reaching goals. Mm-hmm. So I'd love to talk about goals a little bit. Firstly, why do so many people fail when they set a goal for themselves that they feel committed to?
Yeah. Well, this is actually how FIT was born. It was born out of this research. Even if we just look like the average New Year's resolution, right? In January, everyone's committed to the resolution. By the end of January, 80% of people will drop out, right? They'll fail. But they have good intentions. So what happened? Well, in the research, it's what they elaborated on. And if their senses were involved, well, it could hijack everything, right? So it was born out of research in addiction and craving. So there, the stakes are really high, right? If I don't give up something, I'm going to lose my family, or, you know, stakes are pretty high. And these counselors would watch these people commit to something and then give in. And what they realized was going on in the brain is a craving. Cravings are all sensory based. It's a smell, it's a taste, it's a sound. Marketers know this, right? Advertisers know this. They know how to hijack someone's brain to buy something. But these researchers set out to say, can we teach people to use this ability to crave what they want? So yeah, you may smell something and it may make you want something that you know you shouldn't have, but you can then focus on the smell of what's it going to be like when I achieve this goal. The feeling of who's going to be with me. You know, what's that love and connection? So the more they elaborate on their endpoint, suddenly that craving for whatever it was they shouldn't have is gone.
So as you get older, a lot of the goals that you at one time set for yourself, either you realize maybe aren't really achievable, mm-hmm. or maybe they're not even the goals you want anymore. Mm-hmm. So how can someone really level set their goals so that they're doing all of this work towards things that, you know, using your method or however, that they can really bring to fruition?
Yeah. So it begins with knowing your values. And there are exercises in the book, and we do this with corporate teams a lot. It's really fascinating. Like, the company may have values and they're posted on everyone's office and in the waiting areas and, you know, front facing with the consumers. But you ask them what their values are as a team, and rather than them robotically naming the company core values, we really ask them to dig deeper and to have important conversations. What are you going to do if these two values rub up against one another, family and success? Because if you don't anticipate it, you're just going to experience guilt. Because and that may derail you. So we really have, when you're grounded in your values, you get very clear on your goals.
Experiencing guilt. I think working mothers, working women especially, experience that quite often. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think I spent all the years where my kids were little, which I traveled a lot for work, had a very big job, either feeling guilty because I wasn't with my kids when I felt I should be, mm-hmm. or feeling guilty because I wasn't working when I was with my kids. But does your method help sort of getting past guilt that, you know what, let me ask you a different way, because I see in your book about parking unwanted thoughts, and a lot of guilt are unwanted thoughts because there's nothing you can do about it. Mm-hmm. So let me ask you in that way, like, how do you park unwanted thoughts?
That's a great question. And it's very CBT. We're coming back full circle.
Good.
Therapy. You never want to suppress unwanted thoughts because that's problematic and they're going to demand your attention like a toddler. But parking them is almost like visualizing, imagining a bookshelf, and you're putting it on the bookshelf and you're going to come back and read it later. So we use this a lot with athletes, right? They can suddenly get a negative thought when they're in the middle of the game. And we just help them train to just say, park. Park that. I'm going to come to it later. And that's enough for the mind. It's like, okay, we're going to deal with that later. Okay. So parking thoughts, the thing that's really important is you have to go back and look at what that negative thought was if you're going to park it. We have a great story. There's a woman who uses a lot of imagery. She's an Olympic level coach. She's coached the women's soccer team to great success. And she used the park method as well. And one of her athletes screamed back at her, "My parking lot is full." We don't want that to happen. We don't want you to park so many there that it's full. But it's a method for you to focus on the task at hand and know that you're going to explore that negative thought later.
So when you go back to it to explore that negative thought, is that what you refer to as pushing past mental walls?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you're going to go back to it later. And we love like putting time on things because the human brain is wired to be negative. So unpack it for 10 minutes of journaling, like put an endpoint on it so you don't go down another rabbit hole.
Is there a way to change, if understanding that the human mind is wired to give negative thought, is there a way that you can sort of reprogram it to have more positive than negative thought?
We haven't gotten there yet, but
that's the next
really, like the percentage doesn't matter. What mm-hmm. matters is the ones you focus on. Mm-hmm. That's what matters. You could still have 80% negative thoughts the rest of your days. But if you're focusing on the positive ones that are getting you closer, what you want, that's what matters. That's what's going to shape your behavior and your performance and your resilience.
So you mentioned briefly about using this method in team building as well. Mm-hmm. Could we just, because a lot of people that are listening have people that report to them, could we just talk a little bit about how, you know, ways to use this method when you're working with your team?
Sure. Well, we use a lot of measures when we work with team. We have beginner's mind because we're coming in as outsiders, so we automatically have an advantage. And we can see what they don't see, right? So they're like, well, we have values, we have goals. And most of their goals are revenue driven and everyone's racing toward that. But there are communication breakdowns. There's siloed decision-making. There's inconsistent decision-making. So we, just like the book, we're going to start with values, but it's not going to be an easy exercise. We're going to really have you drill down. And then we're going to focus on your communication style. We use a measure that helps us figure out Does someone want bullet points? Does someone need more explanation? So they understand, and they all have one another's profile. So they're less likely to be triggered. That's important. And then the team imagery, or teamagery, as we call it, like, that's really important. Yes, you're all going for this revenue goal, but what are your challenge points? What are your obstacles? How will you handle them when you're there? Because if you don't anticipate, you're going to go back to negative thinking. You're going to go back to automatic thoughts. You're going to go back to old ways of being. So let's collaborate as a team. What are our challenge points? Who's going to get us through this? How will we navigate? You know, in sports, like, I'm a rower, and in rowing, you have to get through the pain tunnel. It's in the middle of the race and you just feel like you're going to die. But because you know that and you've anticipated on it, you're elaborating on something else. Mm-hmm. You're not stuck in that. So you're like, I knew this was going to happen. I'm prepared for it. And I'm imagining being on the podium. And it's just amazing how, like, getting back to my son's story, you know, if what you focus on is going to activate your body.
That's fantastic. So if people want to work with you, mm-hmm. and they want to read your book, so I happen to know you can get your book on Amazon, although you were very nice to give me a signed copy. Thank you so much.
Welcome.
Yeah. Right here. How do they reach you?
Yeah, so we have a website that's called Imagery Coaching, but they could also type in the choice point and that will redirect them. And we're fully booked. We actually need you. We need your help to figure out how to scale this baby. There's such a need for this. Mm-hmm. So sign up for our newsletter, join our waiting, the wait list. We will get to you. The starting place is really the book. I've had people performing at a very high level, Olympians, women in the top 100 women in finance in the world. And they'll say after reading the book, you help me quiet the noise around me so that I could focus on the task at hand. That's amazing. That's a great starting place. So let's start. I'd say to your listeners, let's start there. And then we can work on your team.
That's a beautiful thing. And then just to end, talking now more personally for you, you've given up such great advice. I just want to ask you, is there one piece of advice that has helped you in your life and your career that you can please share with us?
I'd say you're not alone. Even on the days when it feels like you're alone, you know, there's always somebody out there who is, if you reach out to them, they're gonna go with you. Right. One of the things that I'm most proud about is when I was 22, I started an environmental group in my hometown. And they were, you know, and it was a conservative hometown. Everyone called me a tree hugger, but whatever, I didn't care, you know. And I just started with a boat and a clipboard. And that first summer, I recruited hundreds of volunteers. And I'm so proud to say, because once they went out on the water and they started picking up trash, they were in. They were like, this is terrible. What can we do? So fast forward more than 30 years later, they've picked up 3 million pounds of garbage. They have 7 chapters. They're doing incredible education in colleges and water sampling, and the water where I grew up is cleaner than ever. So no matter who you are or how lonely you feel on this journey you're on, you know, find others who believe too.
Thank you, Joe. It was such a pleasure to talk with you. And thank you for listening.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Julie.